I'd like to introduce now Dr. Philip Groves, who will give the discourse on the mandalas and give you a very brief background to Dr. Philip Groves for those who have not met him before. Dr. Groves has a PhD in biochemistry and a doctorate in biopsychology. He has a diploma in naturopathy and has practiced for many years in industry as a microbiologist and chemist. That's not the end of his interests. He's an authority in many other fields, including Egyptology, in comparative religion, psychology, botany, marine biology, and ancient languages. And this is not an exhaustive list of his interests, because there are no sharp edges to this man's interests. And surely mandalas are at the other end of the spectrum, or are they? Dr. Philip Groves, I welcome you to the table.
Well, I think with all these wonderful productions that we have around us, nothing need be said. Thanks for lecturing. But now it's overwhelming to just look at these wonderful displays and to see the incredible creativity that comes from some people who say, I'm not getting very far in this work. This is evidence that something is taking place deep down. And I do thank all who contributed a work, because they're all beautiful, they're all expressive, they all say so much. And so we're going to try and explain a little bit this afternoon of how mandalas come into existence and how they can profoundly affect and influence our lives. And above all, what are the dynamics that stand behind the production of these dynamics? Now, we're talking about Western mandalas. All mandalas belong together. The Western mandalas have some unique properties, which we shall soon discuss, that separate them just a little from Eastern or Oriental mandalas. The word mandala itself is a Sanskrit word which means a magic circle. And that's very different from the Sanskrit word chakra, which simply means a circle. So here we have mandala. And it's the magic circle. But a chakra simply means a wheel or a circle. And you find in occult literature many references to chakras. We're supposed to have chakras up and down our body like buttons on a waistcoat and so on. They're only contemplation centers. They don't actually exist there, although all sorts of experts say, well, they're there, I can feel them, I can open and close them and so on, just like opening and closing one's bowels. But it doesn't work that way. They're meditation centers. And the wisest of the Indian sages say, no, they don't actually exist, but we get feelings in these regions, which we call the chakra centers. If you've ever seen the flag of India, with the red, white and green, there is a chakra in the center. It's not a mandala, it's a pure chakra. It's a wheel with a lot of spokes. Now, the mandala, being the magic circle, has psychic qualities and psychic properties. It's full of meanings, and it's generated from feelings. It's generated from deep internal parts of ourselves. So the mandala is what we're going to concentrate on, rather than the idea of just a circle or a wheel, which may only be a symbol. Now, concerning the pronunciation, in Sanskrit, the A's are pronounced as little U's. So in Sanskrit you would say mandala. But mandala, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is a perfectly acceptable pronunciation. So if you want to be very, very high and flighty, mandala. That sounds impressive. Sort of whispering secrets into the ears of other people. Or mandala, as in darling. Darling, you're gorgeous. Darling, you're beautiful. Well, we can express ourselves that way. All right, well, that's only the terminology. But what is so important is to realize that mandalas grew up in India and surrounding regions in connection with tantric Buddhism. Now, Tantra is a particular mode of psychic and spiritual training which involves a great deal of actual sexuality. And the original scheme was to have married couples who were devoted Buddhists, and under the guidance of a guru or a teacher, they would carry out a series of very, very complicated sexual practices in order to sort of lift themselves up into heaven. Now, why need those special practices? Because most people, if they're enjoying sex, say they are in heaven. But still, this is the traditional way of thinking in the East, and sexuality became an important rocket fuel, as it were, to help the aspiring souls to reach a higher degree of experience within themselves. And the mandalas were diagrams constructed to help people following the whole philosophy of tantric Buddhism to find their way into the center of their life. And so we have the oriental mandala with the following traditional pattern. We simply have a circle, or sometimes there may be a triplet of circles. Inside will be a square, which usually becomes greatly modified, and inside that there may be one, two, or even three circles. Now that's the basic mandala pattern that comes out of Tibetan and North Indian Buddhism. Now people draw these mandalas, and when they draw them, there are certain rules that they must follow. And they use coloured paint, or coloured sands, or coloured grains of rice. They may set up the mandala on the ground, they may set it up on their front doorstep, which they do on festive occasions. They may paint it on paper. Almost any surface will do for the setting forth of the mandala. And the colours that are used, the outer one may be blue, the next one may be green, the next one may be white. And as they're painting these, they are supposed to be reminding themselves of what these colours represent. There is a mental formula that goes with it. And then with the square inside, generally there are all sorts of additions that are made, sometimes very, very complicated divisions, and these represent gates. And then in the corner, or in these spaces, figures of deities, figures sometimes of demons are placed, and the whole thing becomes very elaborate. But there is a specific set of rules that must be followed in setting up one of the traditional mandalas of the East. Once the mandala is made, it then becomes an instrument for meditation and contemplation. And people study it, and they'll try to experience what the outer circle corresponds to inside themselves, a certain set of thoughts, you would say. Then they move to the next circle, they try to discover feelings or sensations or intuitions. And then they'll move through either that gateway, or they'll move around through that gateway, using this as a sort of a mental space which they're going to explore. Now as they pass from the outer towards the inner, and they start to move towards the center, they try to get a heightening or an intensification of their feelings, because they realize that the center represents their central self, the Atman. That's the core of one's being. And if in the right emotional state they can get into that core, the Atman, at that point there will be a magical blending with the supreme Atman of the universe. The two meet in the center of the circle. So our own personal self and the universal self meet and blend. Now that's partly the theory of the mandala as it's practiced in Tibetan Buddhism, in tantric Buddhism. It's a complicated series of procedures. And there are some practitioners with very great mental concentration. You don't even draw the mandalas. They can hold in vision an image of the mandala and go through all their meditations without looking at a diagram. That's something worth practicing as you go to sleep at night. So draw a complicated one, or look at some of these beautiful complicated ones. Remember them, and try to find a way to the centre. It's worth doing. Now, the Western mandala that you've got people been producing is a little different from this. You are not apishly trying to follow an oriental pattern. Or there are many exponents of art in the Western world who will take an oriental pattern, such as a mandala pattern, and they'll build on it. I've got a simple example here. Now here is a simple oriental mandala, but it's been westernized by putting in the little blocks of colour. Now it looks very attractive. In the centre is the Sanskrit word for Om. It's a true mandala, it's a very simple one, and yet it's striking. So that's a westernization of an eastern mandala. Now then people go in the other direction and they will easternize a western mandala. Now some of you remember Bhagwan and Minoy, who used to come to the groups years ago. Then they went to live up the north coast. They went over to India recently. They're now back in Australia. They have produced a mandala which is sitting over on the bench here. Now they took the Enneagram, which is a western mandala, and they easternized it. You see, they have the figure of Krishna in the center playing his flute. That is, playing the cosmic melody. So here we have an easternization of a western mandala. So all sorts of combinations and approaches can be taken. And if we understand this, then we can allow for the fact that an enormous variety of mandalas are possible. In fact, a little later on, we're going to talk about some computer studies which proves the endlessness of mandala generation. Now, whereas the Eastern mandala is constructed according to a very rigid formula, which constrains the practitioner of mandala science, in the Western world, people don't know anything about the theory of the mandala, and so they say to themselves, well, I'd like to produce something that looks harmonious, that gives me pleasant feelings, and enables me to express something that I feel welling up inside. And so people in the Western world are free of those philosophical and religious restraints, which are all the rules of building a very formalized and a very idealized mandala. And those of you who have done these things, you know that you set out with the intention of producing something and you weren't quite certain exactly how it was going to work out, and somehow it unfolded itself. You added little bits and pieces, you added parts of yourself to it, but you brought forth something into birth without all those fixed, rigid, traditional rules that go back for hundreds of years in Eastern countries. So in the Western world, if we're interested in mandala production, we've got a freedom and a spontaneity which is very valuable to us. We're no longer trying to make mandalas according to a fixed pattern. And we may say, but this will take us surely into realms of artistic expression that may seemingly depart from mandalas. No, just look at the variety. Every person has produced such an incredible variety, yet the basic pattern is there in each one. You see, there is an underlying reality that stands behind all these varied forms. And it's that universality that shows that deep down in every one of us there is a common, creative, uniting principle. But in the Western world, to feel that we can generate what we're happy to express and gain a sense of fulfillment, gain a sense of peace out of what we're doing, this is a very important thing. Now this particular Indian mandala, which was sent by now this is a very interesting Indian mandala done by two Indian people who are no longer young. Now this is almost a Western type of mandala. It doesn't have the usual traditional circles and then the squares and then all the religious figures. This is a happy, happy expression of something which is felt, something which is rich, something which is delightful. And the people who produced it said, in India, when there are festive occasions, and we feel the joy of God in our hearts, we just sit down and we paint these to celebrate the presence of God and to enjoy happiness, a state of peace, and godliness. They're doing it as a joyful activity. They're not doing it as a religious exercise following all the traditional formulas. Now, that's what I call the Western style mandala. It doesn't mean to say that our Western style is something completely different. It's just an approach to the generation of mandalas. And so it's fascinating to see that Eastern people can express a freedom and a creativity untrammeled by the traditional approach. And so when we endeavour to draw mandalas, we must feel that we're absolutely free, that there are no fixed rules, that we can express ourselves in any way that we choose. If you give the creative potency in yourself a chance to begin to unfold, it will. Something is hidden away inside that wants to come out, but it never forces itself. So we have to surrender to it to a certain extent, trust in its logic, which has a logic of its own, trust in its truthfulness, trust in its joy-giving capacities. And so we allow something to flow through us. And it's no good saying, oh, I'm not artistic. You draw what you enjoy drawing. The pattern has to come out. Now, Carl Jung, the great psychologist, was the first Western scientist to take mandalas seriously. And it was more or less forced on him. He knew nothing about mandalas, but with some of his patients, they were producing paintings and drawings of visions seen in their dreams, which had a mandala-like quality, and he was very struck with the symmetry and the pleasant harmonious appearance of these figures. So he made inquiries and found out that they were mandala-like figures. And then he went through a very stressful period in his life when he broke his collaboration with Sigmund Freud. The two men separated and went their different ways. Freud stuck to the rigidity of psychoanalysis. Jung wanted to explore the universe. He had a bigger and more inclusive mind. And in the midst of all of this gloom and unhappiness that came to him, having broken a very close and a very meaningful relationship, Jung began to draw mandalas. He just sketched and sketched and sketched, using everything from coloured pencils to even carving them in stone or painting them. And he produced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And for a long time he didn't understand what they were saying. They were just interesting productions from his own psyche. And then he produced a particular mandala one time that touched him, and he felt an enormous peace enter his mind, and he knew that he had been healed of his grief and of the slight cleavage that had occurred in his personality. The mandala drawings had helped him to find an integration. And so he began to study mandalas much more deeply. He studied Chinese mandalas, he studied Red Indian mandalas, he studied particularly Indian mandalas. And he found, from the psychological viewpoint, that all mandalas are symbols of the self. Now we must notice this. The self he is talking about, we must spell in capital letters. Not this silly little self that gets disappointed because it doesn't win lotto week after week in turn. Not the little self that gets jealous and resentful and hostile, that cries at the drop of a hat, or which almost wets its pants like an infant when things go wrong. That's the little self. That is a weak and a very, very disturbing factor in our lives. But Jung realized that there is a deep pattern of integration that is available to all of us, that all of us can grow into a stronger and a wholesome and an eternal self. Now, this was a very daring thing for a scientist to say, because scientists are, for the most part, materialistic, and things like soul, God, that's old hat. We prove that such things don't exist. They prove nothing. They cannot even intellectually prove their own existence. And to say they've disproved something is, of course, talking through a brimless hat that has no crown. And they're able to do that because they're very clever people. Now, Jung was convinced from his Oriental studies that there is a big universal creative self. And he became convinced that all mandalas are expressive of this self. A geometrical diagram which is saying something about the self. And the more he looked at these patterns, the more he realized that the circle represents infinity or eternity, has no beginning and no ending. That the square within that circle represents completeness. Three forces are necessary to produce a phenomenon, but a four-square pattern is the totality. It's everything that comes out of the action of creative forces. And within that completeness, there is the inner circle, and it's that inner circle that is the self. And so the mandala is saying, all of us are embraced by a world process that gives us existence. If somehow we discover the reality of our potencies, the reality of our potentials, and in our own way, drawing upon our own genius, drawing upon all the factors of intuition and insight that we have, if we can make ourselves become harmonious, blended, and somewhat completed beings, then we've got a suitable vehicle within which our eternal reality can emerge and display itself. And so we become an integrated being. The integration of the personality, the integration of one's whole life, became for Jung the fundamental thing that everybody is seeking. You don't have to be neurotically sick to seek it. Every healthy person must seek this greater integration. Now, all this is tremendously interesting, and Jung wrote many books about it. But there are some things he didn't tell us. He didn't tell us exactly what the whole mandala corresponds to in a spiritual sense. And he did not explain how the mind generates a mandala. Now, those of you who produce these magnificent mandalas must say, well, what was it in my mind? What processes were going on there that produced the mandala? You find this very difficult to explain. Very, very difficult. Now, we're not going to try to explain it, but we're going to try and clarify something of the nature of these forces which help to produce the mandala. But we're gradually working up to that. So, we appreciate at the present time that the Oriental mandala is constructed according to a formula. That's the Eastern mandala. The Western mandala comes through our own desire to simply express ourselves and to be ourselves. The approach is different. Now, if we can understand that, if we can understand the mandala carries meaning, meaning of a personal nature, meaning of a psychological nature, meaning of a cosmological nature, because this is an image of the universe as well, and it also relates to God, soul, eternity, we begin to see that these associations and qualities and meanings and values are all tied up with the mandala, then we begin to discover it's a very, very big and a very valuable instrument. Now, it's often said that people who draw mandalas are actually putting them together or constructing them as they're painting them. Now, that is not true. It's not as though a person will say, all right, well, I'm going to make a neat little circle there. Now, just to pretty it off, I'll put something there, and I'll put something there, and I'll put another squiggle there, and another squiggle there. Now, what can we do up here? Oh, a bit of a loop. Sure, we can begin to build up all sorts of geometrical patterns, but a true mandala is not built that way. We don't just put together a mandala like putting together Lego pieces to make some sort of a figure. Actually, the pattern of the mandala as a whole is already in you. And you are just uncovering progressively some of the aspects, some of the features of that mandala to give it geometrical expression, to give it visible expression. Now our personality is filled with all sorts of little clouds, poorly lit places, problems and conflicts, and so much that is within us is obscured by various psychological barriers. Deep down inside, we have a creative pattern. And that creative pattern is associated with those traces of real self that we all carry. But here we have a lot of psychological barriers. And if this is our consciousness, we usually can't see through these barriers to discover what our true inner depths are. Now, if we can thin out some of these difficulties and problems and learn not to identify with things, learn not to become reactive and sense the reality and the feelings of our lives, we may thin it out to such an extent that our consciousness sees a little more of what's taking place, and this creative pattern is able to unfold itself a little more clearly. And the greater this clearing that takes place, the fuller becomes the mandala pattern. So we need both insight into our creative wellsprings, and we also need to clear the way so that more of this inner reality can unfold itself. Hence the need to work on oneself, psychologically, spiritually. So, to construct mandalas of a more and more beautiful nature, they have to be the expression of some intensity of work on oneself. By clearing away some of the mists and some of the clouds, you good people have enabled things in yourselves to display themselves more clearly. Maybe 10 years ago you'd have produced mandalas, but not of the quality that you've manifested in this wonderful display. So this idea of working on oneself to clear the way for a better release of that light that is within you. And remember, Christ once said to the people around him, "Let your light shine before people." Well, this is letting light shine before people. This is unfoldment, this is bringing forth, it's a sort of birth of something very special, something highly symbolic, something highly significant. And so we must attend to that psychological process of preparing the way for the unfoldment of a greater good that comes forth in this geometrical form. Now, because mandalas can be produced by anybody, anywhere in the world, and are actually produced in people's dreams and their visions, and sometimes in their doodlings, and in patterns we see on fabrics, Jung saw that this was proof of the collective unconscious of mankind. He said there is a vast mind which links all mankind together, and that vast mind has universal patterns in called archetypes. The mandala is a kind of an archetype. It's the archetype of the self, of our own personal reality. And the more mandalas are gathered from various parts of the world and showed their unifying pattern, it was able with great confidence to say, well, this shows that everybody has this same creative pattern. It's a set of instructions which is saying, be a whole being. Be a totality. Now, what is interesting about many mandalas is if we study them carefully, we begin to unravel some of their symbolism. The different parts of the mandala do indicate various functions at different levels in our psyche. And they show how a lot of these functions are actually connected together. They show the wiring diagram of our inner life. It's not obvious at first. But as we study things more and more, we see all sorts of fine tracery lines going from one level to another. The linkage between the outer things, the intermediate things, and the internal things become very, very clear. And so we can get a glimpse of the way we are put together. We catch a glimpse of some of the potentials that are hidden within us, and we can suddenly say to ourselves, hey, I didn't know that that was in me. And so we start touching new potentials we've never previously considered. And this is self-discovery. If we produce a mandala, we examine it, we can often find little hints and clues about unexpressed things in ourselves. And those are our potentials which keep on reaching up to the threshold of consciousness, almost tugging at the apron string, saying, hey, let me out, let me out. And that's hyparxis, that repetitious need for the inner life to unfold itself, but in a non-violent way. So the mandala contains a lot of hints and clues about what is taking place or what can take place in our lives to complete ourselves. Now, we've got some very big questions about the creativity that occurs within us. In order to produce a mandala, various nervous pathways in the brain are involved. There are motor nerves that go down to our arms to do the sketching. And there are all sorts of association fibers in the brain, thousands of kilometers of association fibers that link together the different parts of our thinking and our feeling and our memory and our experiencing. And they bring these things together so that the mandala pattern becomes seen by the mind's eye, and so we begin to draw what is coming up into our mental vision. Now we have to say to ourselves, all right, I have this neural network. And as we mentioned, thousands of kilometers of nerve fibers are actually involved in bringing together all the components of the pattern, the mental pattern of the mandala. Now, here is a question. What does this neural network correspond to? Everything corresponds to something in higher life. And so with all these masses of fibers that are helping to produce the physical manifestation of the mandala, what does this neural network represent? It's the outward expression of inward spiritual things. And only we can unfold what that is. So now you're trying to look up books. Books won't tell you anything about it. I've never seen this question stated in any book at all. Whereas the logical question, what does this network of fibers in the brain represent? It's the togetherness of functioning parts. Now we've got to go a step deeper. Inside every nerve cell, now let us say this is a typical nerve cell. Inside the nerve cell is its nucleus. And we have thousands of biochemical processes in these millions of nerves making those nerve actions possible. We are a seething mass of biochemical phenomena taking place all the time. And this is generating a lot of energy, a lot of power. Our brain turns over 24 watts of power a day. That's quite a bit of energy. This slushy, pulp-like stuff that's in there that you can scrape out of the brain with a spoon. Oh yes, it's not very exciting when we look at it from that simplistic physical level. And a lot of scientists are very fond of reducing us to the minimum. They say there's enough iron in the body to make three nails. We've got enough calcium in the body to paint the inside of a chook house. And so it goes on and on. Well, these are simplistic and ridiculous ways of reducing us to the lowest common level indeed. Now, we've got this brain with these thousands of kilometers of fibers. We've got billions of nerve cells with all their enzymic and oxidative activities sizzling away. Now, we have to say to ourselves, to what spiritual realities does the biochemistry of all of these cells correspond? All that seething activity, it comes from a different level of the spiritual universe. What are those levels? What is being represented in the chemistry here of a reality that's seething with its creativity at another level? And then there is a third thing that we must think about. I'm not saying you're going to get answers immediately, but by pondering these things, we start to get the feeling of things. Now, every mandala that we produce is the expression of feelings of a very deep, subtle nature, and behind these stand creative ideas. So, what creative ideas does the mandala we produce correspond to? What are those creative ideas that brings the pattern of the mandala forth? Something is there. Now, we cannot expect to be able to define what those creative ideas are, but to get the feeling of them, to get the feeling that they are present, that they are dynamically operative inside oneself, that's the important first step. So behind mandala production, the nerve activity, what does all that collective nerve activity correspond to? What does it relate to? All the metabolic activities within the nerve cells, what seething reality does that correspond to? Behind the pattern of the mandala, what are the creative ideas in another world the mandala corresponds to? Now these are very challenging things and they should stimulate us. Now there's yet another way of looking at mandala production. In all ancient spiritual and esoteric literature, a garden represents intelligence and the understanding of truth. Now that's a very important principle. According to the biblical story, mankind started off in the Garden of Eden, which would mean a realm of great intelligence and total comprehension of truth. Now that's in a symbolic manner of speaking. But somehow man disorganized himself and he found himself being removed from the Garden of Eden. Just like a drunk being tossed out of a pub. And a flaming sword was placed there so that he couldn't get back. Now all this is pure spiritual imagery. We can't take it in a literal fashion. There's very deep meanings involved. But that Garden of Eden is only a representation of all the knowledge, of all the wisdom, of all the beauty and harmony in the creative universe that generates wholeness of being, harmony of an integrated self. We can only be an integrated self when we perceive all this. And so we can say that in the gardens of wisdom, we have the creative source out of which all art, all architecture, and to be here very specific and very narrow, all mandalas come forth. There are myriads of other things as well. Now when we look at architectural patterns throughout the world, we find that many of them are mandalas. If we take the great Borobudur up in Java and look at it from an aerial photograph, we have this enormous square base and you have a whole series of tiers around it. And then we have an upper platform. And then we have a stupa in the center. And a series of rings with smaller stupas around it. You see, it's a mandala pattern set in stone. But until you get up into a high place and look down, you don't see the mandala pattern, but it's there. Now, so much architecture is like that. And the early architects had that great problem of having a square base and how to fit a circular dome on a square base. That's the famous problem of squaring the circle. This was a major thing, but it's fundamentally a mandalic problem. The mandala shows how it is done harmoniously and beautifully. The architects and the builders, they had practical difficulties. But architecture is just as much an artistic expression of that creative integrating self that we have within us, as is a mandala, or in fine works of art, which give glimpses
of our spiritual reality. So we must realize that all of us have access to these gardens. The holy city of Jerusalem, described in the book of Revelation, that's a mandala. Ezekiel's vision of a city and a temple that he had to measure with a rod, when you read it carefully, that's a mandala. Mandalic patterns fill more of our sacred literature, and they fill more of the world's literature than we recognize. You see, we don't recognize the pattern, but it's there. If you look at a flower, here's a mandala. The outer ring, that's the outer circle, an inner circle inside it. The mandalic pattern shows up everywhere. If you have a cell of the body, the outer circle, the edge of the nucleus, the inner ring. That's a basic mandala pattern. If you have a solar system, you have a sun, and you have a series of planets in their orbits. That too is a mandalic pattern. If you have a spiral galaxy, this too is a mandala with its highly concentrated center and these ring-like structures around it. The mandalic pattern is more universal, and it's up to us to look into the world and see examples of this, because the patterns are everywhere. Now, these mandala patterns, they keep on coming out of our being when we give them the opportunity to do so. But we have to study the process of mandala construction within ourselves. Now, when we paint or draw a mandala, we should make a note of our psychological state. What were we feeling at the time? What thoughts and inspirations were moving through the mind? What sorts of insights were we gaining as we painted certain parts or put other parts in? And we should keep a written record of what was going on whilst we were producing the mandala. We have to keep ourselves in the picture, because we are generating something that is precious to us. We're bringing forth those patterns that are most meaningful to our inner life. We must have a record of what was going on, of what we were feeling, what we were knowing, and what new states were arising within us. One mandala will not unfold all of the patterns of our being. And so we need to draw hundreds of mandalas. You find after a few months or a year or two, the process stops. You don't have to draw any mandalas. Like Jung, you draw one that seems to bring them all together into a common synthesis. And so you've been through your apprenticeship of bringing forth these mandala patterns to show you different aspects of the structure of your inner being and of your potentials. And so that's the virtue of the Western mandala. With our freedom, with our spontaneity, we can allow so very much that is within us to stand forth and to display itself. But again, we raise the question, what stands behind the mandala? What are the processes that bring forth the mandala in the first place? Now, we cannot give a direct answer, but we can give some answers that are very, very suggestive. I better just move this over, because so many of the people over here, all the fingers and tears in the room. Now, we're going to look at an aspect of the Enneagram in a new way. Now, many of you are familiar with the Enneagram. For those not so familiar, I'll just very quickly draw it. We take a circle and divide it into nine parts. And we join those points up according to a certain formula. We get a pattern which looks like this. It's a repeating cyclic pattern. And then we have three other points that make a triangle. So we have 6 points on this cyclic figure and 3 points on the triangle, making a nine-pointed figure. Now we're going to concentrate on this six-pointed figure. And the sequence of numbers is 1, 4, 2, 8, 5, 7, and back to 1. Now you obtain that by dividing 7 into 1. And this keeps on repeating forever and ever and ever. It's called a cyclic number.
There are quite a lot of these cyclic numbers that are known, but this is the simplest of them. Now we're going to construct that six-pointed inner figure in a new way. And the procedure is as follows. We simply draw a line. We mark a starting point. Now we draw a series of lines at specific angles. So there'll be one line that will come out this way, and that'll be at 30 degrees. Then we'll draw another line, and that'll be at 24 degrees. Another line at 24 degrees. It's not quite right. I'll just bring those lines over a little more. I want this to be a bit more symmetrical. Now we'll say that that is 30 degrees. We'll say that's 24. And we'll say that that is 24 degrees. Another 24 degrees, and we have a line coming out this way. Another 24 degrees, the line comes out this way. Two, three, four, five, one more. And another 24 degrees, and that will leave a balance of 30 degrees. Now, if you add all those up, that comes to 180 degrees, which, of course, is the measure of a straight line. Now, let's number these in accordance with this number sequence. But we can't just put down the sequence as it is in that formulation. We have to start putting down the numbers in their order. And so, we shall have 1... 2, and the next number will be 4. And the next number will be 5, and then 7, and then 8. Now, let's resort to this order. Let's connect up these particular points by means of that formula that we have at the top. 1, 4, 2. 8, I'll have to draw that up a little further, 5, 7, 1, so these pens are running out of ink practice. So we've got our six-pointed figure being represented in a slightly different fashion. Sliding all over the board with these pins. Now, I'm going to redraw this so that it's going to look a little more harmonious, but we are constructing that six-pointed figure in accordance with that number sequence that many of you know in connection with the Enneagram. Now, let's draw this a little more accurately. And we'll have the following representation which we can now begin to explore. I've got the exact diagram here that I need to refer to. I hope I've got it. All right, now I think it's as follows. If you use a blue colour, that's not the best. The six-pointed figure. Now remember, it came from a starting point down here. So we just emphasize these lines that move down to that starting point, and we bring them into a sort of a focus or a perspective. Where the lines cross, we can draw in these other lines, and so we have an interesting outline. Now if we start doing some shading, we shall start getting this. Now this is being very crudely done,
But we get the idea that there's a sort of solidity there that's emerging out of this pattern. The thing looks more solid. It's no longer a flat, two-dimensional set of triangles linked together. It's got a depth. It's got a solidity. Now, this part that we're showing in the thickened part, that's a mandala type of structure. And the mandala is the expression of all this creativity which has led to its two-dimensional formation. This is the creative center from which our diagrams come. And all of these are the energies of creation which can only work in your minds. Your minds are the conductors of something coming from a higher source. And it's all those nerve processes, it's all that metabolic activity of your nervous system. It's all the ideas that are flowing into the formation of the visible pattern, which is the end effect. So that is the end effect. The drawing, the mandala, the painting. But all this, the extensive solidity of processes, all this made that end effect become possible. Now, if we can understand this about mandalas, we're going to get to know a lot more about this hidden content of our own mind, which is the instrument of creativity. And if we experiment with some diagrams like this, you'll find that after a while, very interesting things will happen. You'll get intuitions, you'll get little visions, and you'll start to put in some shadowy figures at first. Then these may take on a more definite form, and all sorts of things in this creative part of yourself begin to reveal themselves. This comes gradually. But this is a way of beginning to explore our creativity. Now let us use another example. Suppose we draw a simple picture of a flower with four petals. Now it's only a simple thing, but we feel very pleased with ourselves. Yes, I can look at that and I can see a flower pattern there. Okay, well let's extend it into its depth. Let's bring it down to a vanishing point. And if we start to produce a series of very carefully and closely placed lines, we start to get the feeling that this is a solid structure being formed and produced within us, which stands behind the visible pattern that we've produced. The thing takes on a depth. So all of this was at work within you to produce that simple picture of a flower. The simple picture is actually more complicated in its inner operations than it seems to be on the surface. Nothing in this universe, in the final analysis, is simple. Huge processes stand behind every manifestation. And so this helps us to see that behind everything, no matter how simple, something very big is involved. And our job is to learn what that is. We can only learn to explore it, to feel it, to sense it. To know that it's there, that helps, because then we can start to look for things. And the pattern doesn't have to be very complicated. Supposing we have a short straight line. What can you say about a short straight line? Well, you can use analytical geometry, and you can work out formulae for the length of the line and slope and all that sort of business. That's interesting mathematically, but it doesn't help us to understand very much at all. It only makes us candidate for mathematical examinations. But suppose we do a little bit of creative exploration, say, all right, well, suppose I draw another line there, and I extend it so that it becomes a plane. Hey, this is getting interesting. It's more than a line now. It's a whole plane or level or realm. And we've got another one here. and we start to get all sorts of interesting figures being produced in this one, then we'll produce another one down this way, and our straight line becomes a series of intersecting planes that are coming together and are bringing values and meanings and qualities from a whole series of different directions, and the line becomes the common meeting place
for an enormous number of influences and stimuli that are acting from other levels in our psyche, from other levels in the universe.
And so that line becomes our world line, our geodesic that takes us through life. And it's made up of myriads of energies and forces from planes or levels that are touching and influencing us all the time. So even a simple line has its depth complexity. And that is a very important thing to feel. And so if you experiment with any pattern or any shape that you draw, you'll find that something meaningful will come out of it. So you can take that word Om, the Bindu point, and you can draw every part of that down to a common centre, and you can start to get all your depth perspectives, and you'll find that even that is the expression of something from deep down inside. To see that all of our manifestations come from something creative and moving within ourselves is very important. Now, of course, it's that point from which these things arise. In India, that point is known as the Bindu point. Or we can think of it as the place where heaven flows into the earth. It's like an hourglass. Here is higher life, the spiritual universe. Here is the world. And that point of entry is the Bindu. So things from higher life, they flow into this little seed, this little centre of creativity, and then things begin to manifest and display themselves in the physical world. All right, now the Bindu point is a creative centre through which something from another level flows into us. Now what we're suggesting, if we have a mandala, which we've drawn here, that mandala comes from a creative something which is the mandala pattern itself. And the mandala pattern is an eternal something that's always been present in the spiritual universe. It's always there. We are the ones who uncover the mandala. We uncover what's within us. But it's always been there. That is the thing that's just so hard for us to grasp. To get the idea of this, to capture the idea. You see, people by and large, they've got very little belief. They've got very little trust in themselves. People don't trust themselves. They don't trust the religious, the philosophical, or even the scientific systems that they give their adherence to. They don't trust them. Unless we trust life in ourselves as the creative potency which brings forth all of our manifestations, unless we trust it, we're not going to keep on getting new manifestations all the time. We'll get a few little sporadic expressions. And this great experiment in mandala production shows to each one of you who produce mandalas that something can come forth. And if it can come forth in this way, it can come forth in myriads of other ways as well. And you've got to trust that you've got the capacity to do that. That's enormously important, to trust what is in you, to trust what is capable of coming forth. Now, a few decades ago, a mathematical formula was discovered or rediscovered, and it was fed into a computer with a display screen. And it was a supercomputer, it just wasn't an ordinary desktop. This was a super-duper computer. And
this equation produced what is called the Mandelbrot set. Now the equation itself is very, very simple.
The equation simply is z equals z squared plus c.
Now when you first look at it, it doesn't make any sense. You can say to yourself, well, how can z equals z squared? 2, which will say z is not the same thing as 4, which is z squared. Now let us say that c equals 1. Now let us say that z will start off with 1 also. So 1 will equal z. Now let's have a look at the equation. 1 will equal 1 squared, which is 1, plus the constant, which is 1. Now sum that up, and that gives us 2. Now the trick of the equation is, from the result you get, that becomes the new z.
So 2 will equal 2 squared, which is 4, plus 1, and that will be 5. The 5 is then fed back to become the new z. 5 will equal 25 plus 1, which is 26. And then 26 will equal 26 squared plus 1, and so our number system grows.
So the equation tells you, you start with any number, and it starts to build up. Then you feed up that, you're feeding that built up result to become the next part of the equation, becomes the new z. Z squared plus the constant. And if you keep doing that, you will finish up with an enormous abundance of numbers. Now there are some computers that will carry out several million calculations a second. And it's with these supercomputers that this formula, being fed with small numbers, will carry out billions of calculations in about 10 minutes. And every equation that is solved is plotted on the screen. And so the most remarkable patterns begin to be generated from this equation. Now, if you tried to work it out by hand, these patterns would take up to 10 to the 127th power years to work out by hand. In other words, you can never do it. But because the computer can produce billions of calculations every few minutes, it can work out and plot on the surface of the screen the patterns that are being produced from this equation. Now here are photographs of some of the patterns. Now the patterns are absolutely endless. The patterns are astonishingly endless. There was a program on SBS recently which showed this, and it was Arthur Clarke's program. This is one of the most remarkable equations in the whole history of mathematics. Now obviously we can see mandala patterns, millions of them. Now what is interesting, if we take just one little spot from there, and you can magnify it on the screen, out come millions more patterns. And you take any one of those spots and magnify it, shall we say, 100,000 times, millions of more patterns are there. Different again from what these are. Now this is telling us something enormously important. This is telling us that in the universe there is an endless creativity which, like this equation, it builds on itself and it gets new results which it then uses the fresh building pattern for more results. And this is how creativity comes forth. Something is established, then it is built upon, then that is modified and built upon again. And so throughout the whole universe there is a continuous creation taking place. That's why human minds everywhere, whether it's in the field of music, art, science, literature, are always getting new ideas, new themes for novels, new plots for dramas, new themes for poetry, new artistic representations and expressions, new inventions, mechanically, electronically, and so on, new discoveries in the chemical field. this newness comes about because the divine creative mind, it will not, indeed it cannot stop its multiple generation of new possibilities and new potentials. And we are the devices and instruments through which all this creativity is taking place. Now, we're not saying that the equation is the creativity, it isn't. We're not saying the computer is the creativity, it's only displaying the results of calculations. The creativity is deep within us, it surrounds us, it encloses and includes us. And our minds are the sensitive instruments which, if we make some little harmonious contact with our inner selves, we tune in to this ocean of endless creativity. And from time to time, meaningful patterns, meaningful forms, meaningful expressions flow through us. And we have the joy of producing something like a midwife helping to produce the birth of something new, a new life, a new formation, a new meaning comes into expression. And if we can see our functionality in the universe as co-creators with the divine, which the New Testament describes us as being, don't you know, you're co-workers with God, said Paul on one occasion. Well, this is it. We don't generate the mandala patterns. Even our unconscious mind does not generate them. Our conscious and our unconscious are part of that stem that stands behind whatever pattern there is. That's the stem. That's where our mind, our learning, our memory, our interest, our enthusiasm comes in. These are the devices which help to take eternal patterns constantly being created and bringing forth interesting ones into drawn or painted expression or scientific discovery or an invention or whatever. There is no limit to what we can draw upon. The trouble is the average person says, oh, I'm not able to do that. I'm not smart enough to do it. Look, God is smart enough to generate the endless patterns. You'd be smart enough to pick them up. And that's the fun of being alive. It's part of the fun of being alive. Getting these ideas, getting these stimuli, getting these meaningful things that mean a lot to you personally. It doesn't matter whether they mean anything to anybody else. If they're meaningful to you, if they bring a feeling of peace, fulfillment, then you've gained something. So with this very, very brief introduction to mandalas and the dynamics that stand behind it, I hope all of you are experimenting. Even if it's only in the form of doodling, or sometimes a bit of serious painting, you've got wonderful examples. You can see around you excellent expressions of minds which gather this creativity from a source greater than ourselves and give living expression to it. And if you keep on drawing mandalas for a long time, you're going to learn a lot about yourself because you are exploring your own inner being and you are relating yourself to that pattern of integration, that pattern of wholeness and completeness. So let that be a living stimulus. Thank you.
Dr. Groves. Dr. Groves has agreed to take some questions, and from my own part, there are myriads of questions, but if you'd like to ask some questions, Dr. Groves would be very pleased to answer them.
Alright. Yes?
It seems like you're outlining some principles, and it sounds like we're unconsciously using these principles. Do you know people who are consciously using these principles?
Yes. They exist. So, join them. If we make the aspiration, we can become conscious of these things. We really can. Yes, there are people who are conscious, I won't say of the whole lot, but they're conscious of enough to be able to see what's taking place and to feel that it's a very great cosmic privilege to be, if you like, a device. Not a puppet, but a device through which marvelous things come forth. And that's one of the great joys of living more consciously. Yes, it can be done, and we should aspire towards that. We've got everything in us that gives us the power to be very, very fully aware of ourselves and to know a great deal about the source from which these things come. Yes, it can be done. Now, any other questions? Oh, yes.
The Mandelbrot set appears to have similarities to the Fibonacci sequence.
Yes, there is, that's right, yes.
Could you comment on that further, please?
Well, can't say a great deal. But in the Fibonacci series, we have this, that we start off with zero, and then we add one to it. And that generates the next number, which is one. Then we generate the next number by adding that one to that, so that gives us two. Then we add those two together, that gives us three. We add those two together, the next number is five. We add those two together and we get eight. And so that forms the Fibonacci series of numbers. We build our new numbers on what's gone on in the preceding way, like in the Mandelbrot equation. We get our bigger results by building upon the value of z in the earlier part of the equation. Now the interesting thing is if we carry these numbers out far enough, we can take any two consecutive numbers, especially when they get bigger, and if we divide one by the other, 8 over 5, we start to get a very interesting number. We get a number known as 1.61, and that's the golden mean. The golden mean was discovered by the Greeks. They found a way of dividing a line so that the ratio of one part to another part gives a nice feeling to the mind when we looked at it. For example, when they designed altars in temples, if they constructed an altar so that this side has a unit of one and this has a unit of 1.61, it looked right. It just looked right. Many painters, when they produce pictures, they'll have landscape and they'll have skyscape. When the ratios are 1.61 to 1 in area, that gives the most harmonious feeling. But it's this number sequence, which is rather similar to the Mandelbrot sequence. You keep building upon your earlier results. And of course, the Fibonacci series comes into the generation of all these spirals that we see inside the sunflower. And there are ratios between these spirals and each other which corresponds to this constant figure 1.61. But it's very interesting how the unit of the mile to the kilometre is 1.6, which is pretty close to the golden mean. All right, we'll take another question. And then we need some music. I think I'll ask you a question. Now, did you have a question to ask?
Dr. Graz, I was wondering in the practice of bringing forth mandalas that one would see coming forth a mixture of both positive and negative. So, well, this is how I would imagine it, as in bringing forth things to see about oneself. So, in studying that, being spontaneous and allowing that to come forth, one could actually objectively study that and have a sense of...
That's right. You can begin to see where there are little things not quite right inside oneself. Little projections, little figurines introduced, and they don't quite seem right. As the images of these irregularities, which can point to something that we need to look at a little more carefully inside of ourselves. Mm. We can't completely build up perfect harmony, you know, first time more. Mm. And so there are going to be strange irregularities.
And oneself as an exercise, that is normally quite evident, or...?
Well, it's not always evident, but when we do a bit of thinking and analysing, right, it becomes clearer. Right. But then we should play around a little bit. We've got to introduce some sort of delight and some sort of humour into things. Now, let's take a very well-known symbol, and that is the ankh
and we'll draw it in a sort of a perspective like this. We'll make it a little bit on the solid side. All right, now we can say to ourselves, right, the ink is the outward expression of something which has come from a deeper source. So let's draw it. Okay, well, we start to put in some of these flow lines. We say, all right, well, this flows around like this, and this is going to flow around here, flows around here. And it all comes down to that vanishing point. So we start to put in all these lines of flow from different parts of it. And then we get a bright idea. We say, wait on, there's something missing. Something missing here. Let's see what we can add. And so we'll just add a little curved bit down there. And we'll add that. We start to get interesting things. Now this is only playing around for the fun of it. But we've brought life into an otherwise dead static symbol. And we need to have a bit of fun, but it's still meaningful. It's humorous, but it's meaningful. Because now that we've got the bird image behind it, birds are representations of spirituality, of elevated thoughts. So it's not so irrelevant or irreverent. And if we experiment with things in this way, we're going to get a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, and we're going to learn a lot of new things about ourselves. Thank you very much.